Welcome everybody. Pleasure to have tonight Joan Coburn from the Red Cross. Just a little bit of graphical information about Joan. She's been involved with the Red Cross since the 1960s. She's actually been the national president from 1986 to 1992 and was on the executive for 10 years. And in 1992 was awarded the honour of Counsellor of Honour, which is the highest honour that Red Cross can give, and also was recognised with a gold or a CBE. In 1992, so it's a real pleasure for us to have you along here tonight, especially topical with the work that Red Cross are doing at the moment. So you may not realise we've arranged all this obviously for the earthquake and everything else. So welcome, Joan.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael, and thank you everybody for inviting me here to talk to you about 80 years of New Zealand Red Cross. I'm going to give you a little piece about International Red Cross, then about the national level, and then bring it down to Hastings so that you get a broad brush of what happens with Red Cross. Some things change, of course, and some things stay the same. So how did it all begin? Well, in 1859, there was a battle on the plains of Lombardy in Italy, around a village called Solferino. And it's a little bit east of Milan, to give you some idea of where it is. This was a battle between the French and some of the Italian states. It wasn't Italy at that stage, it were all the little principalities against the Austrians. And Henri Dunant was a Swiss banker, and his desire was to find Napoleon and do a business deal with Napoleon.
Napoleon III, this is.
Yes, and he came across this battlefield, and he was absolutely horrified at the damage that was done to the soldiers of both sides and their horses and any other animals that they used, and the fact that the wounded were just left in the fields where they fell, and nobody bothered to help them, and they just stayed there until they died. He was often referred to as the man in white. I don't quite know why a businessman would be travelling through that part of Italy in a white suit, but he was. And he decided that he had to do something, and he went into the village of Solferino and said to the woman, "Help me to help these people and bring these men into your churches and your halls and whatever." And the woman did. The men couldn't because they were all fighting. And it has been a part of Red Cross for some considerable time that a large part of the work has been done by the woman involved in the organisation in whatever country you may find. So he was actually awarded the first Nobel Peace Prize in 1901. So when things had settled down and he got back to Switzerland, this battle scene really stuck in his mind, and he decided he really had to do something. So he wrote a book called A Memory of Solferino, and it is still available, and it may even be in the Hastings Library. I hope it is. And what he said was, would it not be possible in times of peace to train volunteers to look after the wounded in times of war? And that phrase has stuck with the Red Cross right throughout. This book had an astonishing effect in Europe at this time. They were just coming to the stage of their humanitarian desires and expanding their thinking. And as a result of this book, a group of Swiss gentlemen got together and talked about this idea of training volunteers. And of course, volunteers is right throughout Red Cross and the work that we do. And we are all volunteers except for one or two paid staff. That book was published in 1862. So he got a committee of five together. Two doctors, an army general, a lawyer, and a banker, who was Henri Dunant. And the International Red Cross was born. There's now 186 national societies right throughout the world. I think there's 192 in the United Nations. You cannot have a national society in a country until the government of that country has signed the Geneva Conventions. So once that happens, you can then have a Red Cross or a Red Crescent or a Red Crystal Society. So in 1864, the first Geneva Convention was agreed upon, and that dealt with the wounded and the battlefield. So that was a natural follow-on from what he had seen there. This was later followed by the Wounded at Sea, and after World War I, the Convention on Prisoners of War. Then in 1949, after the Second World War, the Convention to Protect Civilians was developed, and the other three were all updated, and so they are now referred to as the Geneva Conventions of 1949. There have now been three protocols added to that. Rather than go through the very legal and ponderous exercise of doing another convention, they now have three protocols. And New Zealand signed the Geneva Conventions in 1958. It is interesting that in the Falklands War in 1982, when Argentina and Britain were fighting over the Falklands, it's the only time that the Convention on the Wounded at Sea has been put into action. Both sides honoured the convention and they worked out a square in the ocean, so many degrees north, so many degrees south, east, west, and this was a clear neutral zone, and the hospital ships just steamed up and down inside this zone. Both sides in their hospital ships, and the International Red Cross visited the soldiers on the ships and the wounded ones and the prisoners of war, and they were not happy with the fact that the British POWs that the British had caught were down in the holds of the ship in this very cold area, and they were asked to do something about it, and the British did. So both sides honoured the Geneva Convention, and it's the only time this actual convention has been in force or operated on. And Uruguay, of course, was the neutral society that looked after anybody that was on the land. We have the situation of the emblem. The Red Cross on a white background is a protected emblem and is used in times of war. As a national society, our emblem is the Red Cross with the words underneath it in black, New Zealand Red Cross. It is actually protected in New Zealand by an Act of Parliament, and as you will appreciate, it is often misused. And sometimes the worst offenders are the medical centres. We haven't got any press here, no. I wouldn't want that to go too far. And often it's used as a fat plus sign, and when we have any problems with that sort of thing, we just take it to our national office and they deal with it, and you know, point out the fact that there's a whopping big fine if we want to take them to court, but of course we don't want to. The cross is actually five equal squares. So if you look at the cross and have a square in the middle, then there'll be two squares that side, two squares that side. That's how you get your five equal squares. It is not quite the reverse of the Swiss flag, almost. They have very definite lines of the size of their arms, and the easiest thing is to say it's five equal squares, and that's what we've done for many long years now. In 1864, the Red Cross on an armband was first used. We don't ever use that now, but many of you will have seen that armband. In 1920, Turkey was having a little spat with Greece, and they decided that they would use the Red Crescent for the first time. And this has been used by Muslim countries for some time now. It is of equal value. And then the Shah of Iran decided he wanted something too, so he had the Red Sun and Lion. So at that stage there were three emblems. And it wasn't until the Shah was deposed that the Ayatollah said, we're not going to have this, we don't want anything to do with the Shah, so we'll go back, we'll have the Red Crescent. So for many years there was the Red Cross and the Red Crescent, and everything went along pretty well. And then this, of course, made no provision for Israel. In 1948, when Israel was formed, the state of Palestine ceased to exist. But Palestine had its own Red Cross Society, or Red Crescent Society, if they wanted to call it that. So this has been a debate for some time, and it has finally been resolved. And it was still being debated when I was in office, and it's taken until just a few years back now, and there's a folder around about the three emblems of the Red Crystal. So we have the three C's, the cross, the crescent, and the crystal. Now this is what Israel would accept, the crystal going that way, and Israel would accept that. They wanted to have the Red Star of David, but nobody else was going to accept that. So I had some very interesting debates with a rabbi from New York at one stage, when I was foolish enough to say, I do have some sympathy for you. And after several back and forth emails and letters and all the rest of it, I had to say, I can't do anything about it, but I sympathise with you. Thank goodness I got out of that one. It caused a problem in the fact that the Palestinian Red Crescent was not really an official group, because there was no longer a state of Palestine. So the trade-off was that the crystal was introduced, which Israel could use, and the Red Crescent Society of Palestine would be recognised. So everybody's happy at the moment, anyway. So we've got the three emblems. We also have what is now called the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, which was originally called the League, and that was formed in 1919 by an American called Henry Davidson. He was actually another banker. I don't quite know why it's bankers that seem to get things going, but they did. And the position of the Federation is a peacetime operation that looks after earthquakes, tsunamis, floods and all the rest of it, and refugees at times. And of course, every now and again, the refugees are war refugees as well as being misplaced or displaced people. So that they do interlap sometimes. But they are quite separate organisations, but all under the banner of Red Cross. It wasn't until 1919 that New Zealand first sent a delegation to Geneva. But of course, at that stage, we were not yet a national society. We are governed by seven principles, which were brought in and agreed to at an international conference in 1946. The seven principles are humanity, which is pretty easy to understand, impartiality and neutrality, which is very hard sometimes when you are in a situation when you know jolly well the other guy's wrong, but you're impartial and you're neutral, and that's what you have to do. And that's why I don't like press being here when I talk, because now and again I say something that really should not be recorded. Neutral, of course, we are independent, which means we are not controlled by government. We are completely independent national society, and we do not do the government's bidding, but by the same token the government, particularly in New Zealand, will channel some of its aid through New Zealand Red Cross. And this happens in quite a few countries, but they know that it's done on a neutral basis. And if they were to say to us, well, you can only give it to yellow people, you can't give it to blue people, then we would not take it. And we have in the past said, no, we won't take that unless we can do it on a neutral and impartial basis. Voluntary service, of course, and unity and universality. Now, unity means that there's only one Red Cross in every country. You can't have different groups calling themselves Red Cross. We're all one. And universality means we're worldwide. So, in New Zealand, how did it all begin in New Zealand? Well, around about 1914, which is just at the time of the First World War, there were little groups around the country, sewing groups mainly, for men going overseas to fight. And I've got to be very careful how I say this. They were Sister Susie's sewing shirts for soldiers. And sending socks too. So in Wallingford in Central Hawke's Bay were one of the first to have a group, and they had six sewing machines there, and they were the hand operated ones, you know, because there was no power, and they used to come in the horse and gigs or on a horseback to Wallingford, and it's a big homestead, and they had a room set aside where these machines were set up, and the ladies would come and do their work. And it's the homestead, of course, of Mrs. J. Ormond originally. So the Governor General, who was the Earl of Liverpool, decided that all these groups throughout the country should sort of get together, and he suggested that we become a branch of the British Red Cross. So we became the New Zealand branch of the British Red Cross and the Order of St. John. And for many years we operated in conjunction with the Order of St. John, and we put out first aid books and the training and all the rest of it together. We're now quite separate now, but for quite some time we were. There was a hospital ship that went off, the Nahini, and the medical officer on board was Colonel W.E. Collins, who ended up being one of our national officers in the very beginning. And his daughter, Dr. Judy Wilson, is been a long-serving member of Red Cross in Wellington. And her husband, who's just died last year at 93, was one of the prisoners of war on the railway over the River Kwai. So that family has had a particular involvement in Red Cross. This first hospital ship was out on Anzac Beach. When I first took office, our constitution said that the Red Cross would supply hospital ships and hospital camps and all sorts of other things, and we sort of looked at each other and said, in this day and age, there's no way we can supply a hospital ship. So we changed our constitution, and it's gone through several changes since then. One of the things that came over from the early days was the VADs, the voluntary aid detachments, and some of you may have family members who, I know there's some Red Cross people here, who have involvement with the VADs, and it was an order that was founded in 1909 in England, and they were field nurses mainly in hospitals in UK and Europe. Many VADs in the time of the First World War had actually trained in England, so they went back to England to serve, not as New Zealanders, but as part of the English structure where they had done their training, and most of them paid their own way to get back there. And they served in Alexandra and in hospitals in England, mainly Brocklehurst, Forest Park, Moulton-on-Thames and Codford. The VADs trained in first aid, home nursing, health and hygiene. And her uniform was a blue serge suit. Had to be over 23 years of age and done at least 3 months training in hospitals before you could go overseas. So they served as nurses mainly, ambulance drivers, cooks, nearly always in the Western Front, in Mesopotamia and Gallipoli. Agatha Christie was a famous World War I VAD, and Hetty Jacks, who was Hancock's half-hour, she was another one in World War II. Violet Jessop trained as a VAD. She was a stewardess on the Titanic in 1912. She survived that and was aboard the Britannic as a Red Cross nurse when it sank in 1916. And she survived that. So she actually died in Suffolk at the age of 73. So I would love to get her complete story. So it's just amazing that those two major things. New Zealand had its own training from 1924 onwards. And it was about the 1960s that it was actually disbanded because circumstances changed. The hospitals didn't particularly want what they saw as amateurs being in their hospital. But at the time, and certainly in the war years, they served a valuable service and were very much welcome, particularly when they worked over the weekend and gave ordinary nurses a spell. Of course, there were several VADs still alive, quite elderly now, but one in particular, Margaret Rankin in Wellington, can still fit into her VAD uniform, and she's in her 90s. I'm very envious of that. But just a matter of probably 18 months, 2 years ago, she came across a road accident, so out she hopped and did her first aid, and she was there until the ambulance came, and she still knew her training, so that's quite an amazing thing. And she has received the Paul Harris Fellowship from Rotary, which is quite unique for somebody outside of Rotary to get it. Now, fundraising in 1917, there was a copper trail along the railway line from Auckland to Wellington, and the competition was to see who could get past the halfway mark first, whether it was Wellington or Auckland. And of course, just recently we've had coins for Christchurch here in Hastings and in Napier, and over $13,000 was raised for the earthquake. You may have seen the photograph in the paper, and I think it was last night. So we worked in Pukehua Sanatorium with the wounded soldiers coming back, and the Waipak branch looked after that. And they now have long since been closed as a sanatorium. But there's now a gala weekend, and the Red Cross is still involved there as a fundraiser. So as you know, in 1931, Hawke's Bay got hit by an earthquake. And although some people refer to it as the Napier earthquake, I always refer to it as the Hawke's Bay earthquake. And although Napier was absolutely destroyed, Hastings was as well, to not quite the same extent. But now, there's a book there called The Geneva Connection, which was written for the 50th anniversary of New Zealand Red Cross, and it has this gorgeous photograph in it of Miss Emma King. Now, she was a hairdresser in a building on the Bream Parade, and when the earthquake struck, she quietly closed up her business, put a hat on, got her bag, climbed down, it was on the second floor, climbed down the stairs, which were pretty badly damaged, and walked down to the Red Cross office, which I think that stage was the Willard Hall in Carlisle Street, which is about where the optometrists, Bennett and Pearson, are now. I think that's about where that hall was. It's long since gone. But can't you just imagine it? Putting her hat on, getting her bag, and off she went. She knew exactly what she had to do. And it's a lovely photograph in that book as well. And Margaret and Tom Hope from Waipakura, some of you may know, they were on their way to a wedding in Hastings and, of course, couldn't get there, so they turned around and went back and sorted everything out in Waipakura for the Red Cross as things developed. So in Wellington, in the National Office at that stage, they got the message about 12 o'clock, 12 noon, that there was this big earthquake. And by 6:30 p.m., they were on the road. They had doctors and nurses, they had medical supplies, blankets, crockery and food, and they got to Hastings about 2 a.m. in the morning. Now you will appreciate it that they are what we would now call vintage cars. Some of them probably were canvas tops. In fact, I would think most of them were canvas tops. So travelling through, although February was quite a warm month, it was quite an achievement for them to get there. They came first to Hastings, and when they saw everything was going okay in Hastings, they then went on to Napier. The Taranaki Red Cross came through to Greenmeadows and looked after the patients that were on the race course in Greenmeadows. And both Nelson Park in Napier and in Hastings were set up with army tents and as a Red Cross base. And there were also depots, Waipak, Dannevirke and Palmerston North, where people being evacuated were given food and drink and any help that they may need. And of course, as the hospitals filled, first Waipak was filled and then Dannevirke and Palmerston North, they were taken by train to Wellington. And there were 10 patients per van, and there were 8 vans, and each had a trained nurse plus a VAD. So this was the jolt that got New Zealand deciding that we really needed to be a national society in our own right, and got the word through to Geneva that, hey, we wanted to be a New Zealand society, not a branch of the British Red Cross. So on the 22nd of December 1931, we became the New Zealand Red Cross Society. And our first president was Dr. Collins, who was the medical officer on the first hospital ship in the First World War. It's interesting, and it's always a joke between the Australians and ourselves, who were in the same situation. They were a branch of the British Red Cross. They take their foundation date from 1914, when they were a branch of the British Red Cross. We take it from when we became a national society in our own right. So, you know, we like to tease each other about that. Right throughout the history of those very early days, Mrs. T.H. Lowry, the name features in just about every branch and on every occasion. She was elected president in 1936 and served till 1939. She was the first woman president of New Zealand Red Cross, and it was 50 years before the next one was elected, and that was 1986, and that was my honour to be the second woman elected as a national president. So we had Hawke's Bay Centre, and Hastings was a branch of Hawke's Bay Centre, and Napier was a branch. And we split into three, and it became Northern Hawke's Bay Centre, Hastings and District Centre, and Central Hawke's Bay. There were subgroups out of Hastings. From Hastings branch, it was Havelock North, which had a very distinguished history while it was still operating. Tiawonga, which took in Hamoana and Clive. Waimara and Maraetotara. Elsthorpe and Maraekākahu. Now we're back to Hastings branch, and we're now part of the East Coast area. You'll appreciate this is an organisation that changes and moves with the time as is necessary. So the Hastings branch was actually formed on the 23rd of February 1932, so virtually a year after the earthquake. And the Mayor of Hastings, Mr. G.F. Roach, called a meeting. He was to play a pivotal role in the Red Cross in the early days. And following on from his position, so did the following mayors, in many ways helping Red Cross get established. And if you read the early minute books, quite frankly, it's a who's who of Hawke's Bay names. It's just amazing. Mrs. Helen Lowry, of course, was very active in it. Mrs. E.J. Herrick, Mrs. Pickering, who was the first woman JP in Hawke's Bay. Miss Holland from Woodford House. And then Mr. F.J. Herrick, who was the chairman. Selwyn Avril. Mr. Redgrave and Madison, who was from the Borough Council, Dr. Cashmore, and Mr. H. Tate was the secretary. There's also Deaconess Holmes and Ensign Armstrong. So they immediately had a nursing division and a relief committee. Membership fee was 2 shillings and 6 pence. Now you don't have to pay a membership fee, but if you want to get a newsletter and be kept up to date, most people pay $5. But it's not compulsory to be a member of Red Cross. You simply sign a document to say that you will abide by the fundamental principles of the international movement. One of the first things that they did was to request knitters and wool, 3-ply for babies, 4-ply for socks and jumpers. And today, the Hastings branch still knits for prem babies in particular. And for those of you who are not aware, the prem baby size is about the size of an orange, about that size. And they knit bonnets for this, and it goes up to the hospital in Auckland. And that's a particular project that they have, and are very pleased to have it. The first depot for Hastings was the YMCA building, and it was open on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Mrs. Lowry guaranteed the rent for the building for 6 months. And she also, when she was president of the National Society, because there was very little money around and we weren't particularly wealthy, and we still aren't particularly wealthy, the secretary of the Red Cross, there wasn't enough money in Kitty to pay him. So Mrs. Lowry paid his wages. The District Nurses Association donated £6 and promised £50 worth of goods. And then Archdeacon McLean and Father Stewart and all the local doctors, I can't imagine this happening today, were all added to the General Committee. But it does show the dedication of the churches and the medical profession in getting Red Cross up and running. Doctors in those days would have been extremely busy, just as they're busy today, but it's a much bigger population. The Relief Committee met at least once a week, and remember this is just a year after the earthquake. They generally met in the late afternoon, and on one particular occasion the meeting went to 10:35 p.m. So there must have been some good debate at that meeting. And they were just helping the citizens of Hastings. And then a request came from Havelock North, we would like some assistance. And Hastings said, yes, of course, we'll help Havelock North. So 2,500 parcels of clothing were received and 2,000 pairs of boots were received. Of those, 300 were ready to distribute, 500 were able to be repaired, and the rest were useless. And unfortunately, that is the sort of thing that still happens today, that some people see Red Cross as a dumping ground, and some clothes and goods just have to be dumped. Some can be cut up for rags. When the floods were down in Invercargill a few years ago now, it actually took them 10 years to clear all the stuff that had been donated to them. And this is one reason why we say we don't want goods, we want money that can be used there, not only in New Zealand, but overseas as well. We don't send clothes or anything overseas now. Because if you send that over to a disaster area, it creates another disaster. You have to have people to distribute it and to sort it, and you've got to be culturally sensitive and all sorts of other things. And most times the goods can be purchased within the country itself or within the next door country, so you're creating an economic disaster as well. So that's one reason why we don't take any goods anymore, unless there's a particular call for blankets, which is something that we probably do take. Yeah, I love the language of the minutes in the early days. The mayor and Mr. and Mrs. Herrick waited upon Mr. Hashier for a contribution. And of course, Mr. Hashier was a tobacco company, and they obviously were after some cigarettes and all the rest of it, so yes. So a little while later, the stocks in their depot were absolutely depleted, so they had to close it. There was a joint meeting with Red Cross and the Order of St. John of Jerusalem to coordinate services, the finance, the advertising, the appropriation of war funds. We were still dealing with that. The assignment of work, street appeals. This actually went on for quite some time that we worked with St. John. All first aid training for men was done by the Order of St. John, and once trained they were to wear the St. John uniform, but they could wear a Red Cross armband. All the women were trained by Red Cross and wore the Red Cross uniform, which was the nursing capes and the white uniforms, or the blue serge suits if they weren't actually nurses. But all the certificates had equal value. On the 11th of June in 1932, it was decided that that would be Red Cross Day, and they decided to canvass urban areas of Hastings and the settlements of Hamoana and Tiawonga, Havelock North Township, and Clive Township. We now have the 8th of May, which is now worldwide Red Cross Day, and that's the birthday of Henri Dunant, so right throughout the world. And as you know, New Zealand's the first one to see the light of day. We are the first ones to celebrate the 8th of May. And we have had many occasions when we have done something special and sent a message to Geneva to say we have started the celebrations and move the torch on. This particular collection, the VADs helped to collect, and £336, 10 shillings and 1 penny was collected. So there was a street appeal. We then went to door knocking, and until that got too hard with too many dogs around, and I was very fortunate, I was never bitten by a dog, but some of our people were. I was always very careful, and I think they probably could smell the dogs on me off the farm, so I was probably all right. Then we went to a telephone appeal, which was very successful at first, and now we're back to a street appeal. And just this street appeal that we've had, and as you know, the money all went to Christchurch. I was talking to my grandsons just after that, and they said, well, what did you do on Friday, Nana? And I said, I stood on the street corner begging. And they looked at me. Then I explained that it was for Red Cross. And that was okay. So, but of course, this year in particular, there's been some wonderful collections given by all sorts of organisations. The ballet took up a collection. A lot of the concerts at the wineries took up collections. The schools and just about every organisation. Michael had a talk in the Havelock North, and that was for Red Cross. It's absolutely incredible. And if there's time, I'll give you an update on the figures from the earthquake appeal. In the early days, of course, they advertised on wireless, which is a term that's not used very often these days, and the theatres, the picture theatres, of course, because there was no TV or anything, so that was an obvious place to have it. Now, of course, we have posters and radio and TV. Two Hastings members are part of a team that works on radio kidnappers and broadcasts a Red Cross half hour on the second Thursday of the month at 5:30, and that's a lot of fun as well. We've been just about into the end of our fifth year doing that program. Of course, this 1932, the Farmers Union decided to help. The Rugby Union supplied tickets for a raffle, and the Boy Scouts were asked to help sell them. And the earthquake funds were to be used for earthquake victims only. And we make that very clear, that the money collected in the name of an appeal is used for that appeal, and nothing is taken out for administration. And that applies for the Christchurch appeal, and all the money that's been raised goes to the people in Christchurch. And if, well, there is tremendous administration costs, and as a national society we are going to bear the cost of paying the extra staff. Some are volunteers and some need to have a wage. So that has been our policy for many years. And in international appeals, when we appeal for example, the Christmas Boxing Day tsunami, all the money that was raised in New Zealand all went there, certainly via Geneva. And that was such a fantastic appeal throughout the world that Geneva said, just hang on, we haven't got everything in place, we're getting inundated, just hang on to that money. So we said, okay, so we put it in a bank account and it got interest, and the interest as well went for that tsunami, so we didn't take anything out at all. Then Sister, and I think the name is Present Restori, she was the first District Red Cross nurse to come into Hastings. And she started home nursing classes, and they were held in the council chambers. And actually, most of the early meetings were held in the council chambers, and it wasn't until later on that Red Cross moved to its own office. The minutes show that Mr. John Plummer received £5 towards a replacement of an artificial leg. And a charity ball was organised in August with a net profit of £110. And the ball was to be held for many years after that. I'm not quite sure when it ceased to operate. Mr. Pickering was appointed the Secretary Treasurer. The meetings, if they were not held in the council chambers, they were held at Duff and Abel's office. And in September, the funds were sent after the earthquake in Wairoa, and goods were sent to Mohawker and Nuhaka. And Hastings worked with the unemployed, and the depot opened again from 9 a.m. to noon, 3 days a week. In alternative days, being Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday, the secretary was expected to canvass for membership. It doesn't say how well he did. As a fundraiser, in December, an ice cream and soft drink store was held at the Red Cross, with the committee covering the costs if there were any. As Mrs. Lowry was president of the Hastings Community Club and the Hawke's Bay Red Cross Centre, it was agreed that all club members be made official members of Red Cross visiting the hospital. And I don't think anybody ever dared say no to Mrs. Lowry. And I'm sure I never had that effect. My friends will tell you anyway. She was a formidable woman, but she had a way of getting people to do things, and it all worked, I can promise you that. And that was the first year of Hastings Red Cross. The following years, we'd see a threat of influenza epidemic, which didn't eventuate, but they were getting prepared for it and talking to the hospital board to see how many vaccines they had, how much serum they had. And they had home nursing and first aid classes, of course. Our first cookbook was produced, and of course we've had several since then. Junior Red Cross was formed. It was then later called Red Cross Youth, and now it's all incorporated into the membership anyway. Molly Nartush, who some of you know the name, formed the first junior Red Cross in the country at Mariah Turtra, the school there, and she was to be a stalwart of Red Cross for many, many years, and always at the youth side helping there. At the time that the nurses went out of wearing veils, the lovely little girls, but I won't tell you which school, locally, wanted to still wear their veils. And we had an awful job trying to persuade them that, hey, the nurses don't wear them anymore, so perhaps you need to come, you know, into the modern world and not wear them. We finally got through, but, you know, it was so reluctant that they gave up because they just loved being little nurses. And that's fair enough, too. And it's recorded that the Governor-General actually attended the Red Cross Ball in 1935. And the VADs formed a guard of honour, and the Red Cross youth were out there as well. And I can just imagine those wonderful people in their uniforms, and their shoes would be polished, and they'd be standing up straight, ready to meet the Governor General as a guard of honour. The first real home for the Hastings branch was the Farmers Meat Company, and it would appear that they shared the facilities of the Women's Division of Federated Farmers, which is now called Rural Woman. And then in 1936 they moved to a commercial building in Heratonga Street. Later they were moved to Elbourne Street, later still to Avenue Road, and now the Hastings office is back in Heratonga Street, the Stortford Lodge end. Hastings also showed the film called White Angel at the Regent Theatre. And it was, of course, about Henri Dunant and his white suit that he wore. And then just a matter of two or three years ago, Red on the Cross was the latest film that was produced, and that showed in the Century Theatre. And, of course, was the story of Henri Dunant, and it was in colour. The first one, of course, was in black and white. So in the war years, Hastings, of course, spent their time eating trains, transporting wounded soldiers, giving out cigarettes and parcels for refugees, rolling up bandages. All the work that you associate with Red Cross. And I think it was around about 1960s or even later, might have been 70s, that Red Cross trolleys in the hospital finally put away the cigarettes and didn't sell them anymore. And that was another big debate that we went through. And of course, five Hastings VADs who'd been trained here were selected for overseas service. In 1960, the first New Zealand Red Cross field delegate was sent overseas. This was the first for coming under the umbrella of New Zealand Red Cross. It was Barbara Tomlinson from Gisborne, and she went to Morocco. She was a physiotherapist, and 10,000 people had been paralysed with tampered cooking oil. And you know, it's not so long ago that there were some problems in India with tampered cooking oil. There were no physiotherapists in Morocco, and she was the first one there, and a woman. It was quite an achievement to go, and quite a story behind it all. And Hawke's Bay has a very good record of sending delegates overseas in the troubled zones that we have. Diane Russell, who's a lab technician, I think she's still working in the Hastings Hospital, went down the Thai-Cambodia border. Lynn Anderson, who's a nurse living in Napier now, she was a nurse on the Thai-Cambodia border with the refugees coming across. Dr. Peter Fleischel, senior, went looking after refugees and got so hooked on the job that he joined the United Nations, so we lost him. But he's the medical advisor for the Napier branch. Glenn Ars was a nurse from Dannevirke who went with the boat people. Most of you, I think, will know Margaret Bryson, who trained in the Hastings Hospital. And she's the only one that has received the Florence Nightingale Medal, which is the highest award in world nursing, and is only given out every 2 years, and only 50 worldwide are given out. And she has that, and she also has a Queen's Honour. Some of you probably will know Mary Jane Hurliston, who is an ophthalmologist. She went to China a couple of times, and I don't think we were very popular with her patients, and I was one of them. She went away when I asked her if she'd be interested. And our latest one away is Andrew Cameron from Central Hawke's Bay, who's at Ossetia, and he's been away several times too. So over the years, fundraising. There's been the Christmas market, which Janet Allen and Pat Boyden, who was the wife of the deputy mayor at the time, they organised the Christmas fair for some considerable time. And there was Christmas wrapping at Kmart. There was Spud in the Bucket, which was an awful lot of fun. Great competition between friends and family to see who could grow the best lot of potatoes from a bucket, one potato in a bucket. And for many years, there was a gentleman who rolled newspaper and sold it to the butchers and what have you. He was quite a figure of Hastings branch. Beryl Rinders was the health and welfare officer for some time, and she put together a video on disabled people, and she had a group of people. Her partner was in a wheelchair, and she had a group of people that she took around to schools, and they were all willing to take part and talk to the children about it. And you know how some children are afraid of people in wheelchairs and afraid of people with their arms missing? She just did a wonderful job breaking down those barriers, and it's a very good video. But she no longer is working with us, of course. Meals on Wheels, of course, and I presume that a lot of you are drivers, or if not, you have been. Transport drivers, knitting of course, is still happening. And the shop is still operating in Hastings. We look after refugees. We have a response team who's been active in Christchurch. And we've got a member sitting at the back here as well. And Breakfast in Schools. This is a program that operates in Decile 1 schools. It has been a contentious issue. A lot of people in New Zealand say we shouldn't have to do this. But the truth of the matter is, there are children at school that are hungry. And the teachers have said, once this scheme has been going for 2 or 3 months, that those children are much better behaved, much more alert, and much happier children. And it's a reality that we just have to face. And there's all sorts of debates, of course, as to what should happen and who's responsible. I just want to throw to you now some names that some of you will know who've been very active in Hastings Red Cross. And Joan Velvin is one. And she was the first woman appointed to the Red Cross Foundation, which meets in Wellington, and is a separate entity that was set up by one of our former national treasurers, who went on to be chairman and then president. And it's a separate fund which people give to, knowing that it will accumulate and the interest will be used to run the national office for example, so that Secretary General gets his pay and tops up projects and all the rest of it. When it first started, we thought $1 million would be quite a good sort of sum. I might say it's much more than $1 million now, and it's very much needed, but it is quite separate from the Red Cross, and people give to it knowing that the purpose of that is to keep everything ticking over properly. Some of you will know Pam Lockhart, who was secretary here in Hastings for many years. And Topsy Bolt, who was a VAD, and she and her sister for years used to shell walnuts during the winter months because they didn't have TV and they didn't want TV. So they shelled the walnuts and sold them in lovely bags in the shop or at gala days or whenever. Jean Orbell was another one who was very active, and the Orbell name is well known in Hastings. Ruth Flashoff, some of you will know, and Beat Chapman out in Hastings. And Nanette Payton, Murray Massey and Felicity Kelly all worked in the National Office at some stage, not all together, separately, but they're all in Hastings now and had been active in Hastings for some considerable time. And for many years, the matron of the Hastings Hospital was on the committee, and I think probably Sylvia Frame was the last one to do that. And of course the whole hospital situation has changed completely in the structure, and they're now, as you know, principal nurses, I think is the term that they use. So you can see that Hastings has had a very distinguished life, and it continues to serve the community very well. Have I got time to give an earthquake update? Thank you. Thank you so much to everybody who has given to the Red Cross earthquake appeal. It's been absolutely fantastic, the response that we've had, and it's very humbling to realise how much respect the Red Cross does have in New Zealand. As I said, all the money goes exactly to Christchurch, to the appeal there. And one of the commissioners on the body is Jerry Talbot, who actually came from Central Hawke's Bay, who was Secretary General of New Zealand Red Cross for many years, then went to Geneva, served in Geneva as head of the Asia Pacific Department, and then did a stint in Africa, and then decided he would retire, so he came back to New Zealand and lives in Napier now. And at the time of the Boxing Day tsunami, he was asked if he would come back and look after the Maldives. Some of the islands were absolutely flooded, and the whole population of one island was moved completely to a new island, and everything was set up, and Jerry was in control of that. He's one of the commissioners, so you know, you don't actually ever retire from Red Cross, strange as it may seem. I can only give you the figures from the end of business on Monday, which is last Monday, not yesterday, and appreciate that the figures will be more than what I'm saying, because that's the reality that we're faced, but over 51 million has been raised, and several hundred thousand a day is still coming in. And of that, 35 million has been paid out through emergency and hardship grants. Now, yesterday was the final day for anybody to put in an application to receive a hardship grant, and the Commission will be meeting today to discuss what form the next lot is going to be and how they're going to allocate it. Over 40,000 applications were processed by staff and volunteers in Wellington and in Christchurch. And as a result of an international agreement that we have with Lions Club International, the Lions are working alongside Red Cross, and there are 75 of the Lions Club members working in Christchurch and two in the National Office. There's also a bereavement grant of $10,000 to the families who have lost somebody, and it doesn't matter where they come from. If they've lost somebody and it's been identified, that family gets $10,000. Over 340 Red Cross volunteers and staff have been working in Christchurch, and all bar one of the Hawke's Bay response team have been down there helping, taking it in turns, usually a week to 10 days at a time. One of the team is actually a fully trained search and rescue person. This is the first time that New Zealand has accepted the offers of aid from other societies. It's been offered quite often at other times, mainly Australia, Britain and the US. They're always the first to offer, and we've always said, no, we're okay, we can manage ourselves. This time we needed help, and we very quickly recognised that we needed help. And apart from Australia and Britain and USA, offers also came from Canada and Japan, of course. And I think there is still a member of the Japanese Red Cross looking after the families in Christchurch whose bodies haven't been identified yet. And of course those parents probably don't speak English. China and Taiwan are also the ones that have offered help, and it's been accepted in various ways. So that's an 80-year romp through Red Cross. Are there any questions?
Joan, you've been very modest about your involvement, and I'm about to ask this because she's my aunt. So I can remember going to Red Cross with Mum at Pātauka, and I assume assume that that was your first involvement. I'd be really interested to know a quick sort of outline how you went from being involved in the Pātaka branch to hold the positions that you did hold.
I think I was a little bit lucky that doors opened at the right time. I started in a small country branch, Waihau Pātaka branch, and the first meeting of that branch was at my mother-in-law's home. I wasn't involved in the family at that stage, I was still to come in. And I took office in the branch at one stage and went to Napier to the centre meetings down there and took the position of chairman of the centre and went to Wellington to the council meetings in Wellington. And when I went as a delegate, the next year I would pay my own way and go as an observer. So for quite a few years I had the involvement of being down in Wellington where the action was happening. And then I was involved in the 50th anniversary of the Red Cross, and the conference meeting was here in Napier and Hastings were helping there. And I was invited to stand for the National Executive, as it was called then. So the following year I let my name go forward and I was elected to the National Executive, and 3 years later I stood for the position of National Chairman and missed out. And I was quite happy with that. And then a group said to me, come on, put your name forward to be National President. And I actually didn't see myself as a president at that stage, but they had confidence in me, and there were four stood, two women and two men. And I was lucky enough to be elected. So that's the process, briefly, how I got through it all.
The 51 million, is that all from New Zealanders or some
of it's from overseas? Some of it's from overseas. The Red Cross Societies of England, Australia, Japan, the USA are all holding their own appeals. So it's Red Cross money in those countries coming direct to Red Cross in New Zealand. I don't have a breakdown of those figures, but yeah, it'll be substantial amounts. And of course it's still coming in.
Can you just explain again how the administration and wages are paid?
They're going to be paid out of our general funds.
Which comes from
where? Well, that's the cake stories and all that sort of thing that we do, you know, and I think I'll be baking cakes for some time to come. Yeah. But people do leave money for that particular purpose, and, you know, the usual fundraising things that we do normally throughout the year. Normally the annual appeal would go into that sort of bucket, but this year, of course, it all went to Christchurch. So from that point of view, it's quite a major contribution of funds that would normally come in to help us run ourselves, but that's how it's been done.
Joan, you and I were talking briefly earlier about visiting the museum in Geneva, and you mentioned in particular something that struck you in the memory of that place. I mean, I've visited it twice, and you know, to me it's the most amazing museum, which tells us exactly the wonderful beginning of it, from all we do not, and the international strength of it, and I wondered whether you might like to share that with me in particular.
Yes, thank you. The museum in Geneva is absolutely fabulous. It's a very modern museum. It's quite different from the old-fashioned types of museum. It's set up around the walls are the tablets that say when each country became part of the international movement, and of course 1931 is New Zealand there. But the particular thing that Eileen's referring to is a concrete cell that's part of the museum, and it's 6x8 or whatever the measurements are. But in that cell were crammed prisoners, and it's absolutely appalling when you stand there and you can see the marks on the concrete of the feet. In appalling conditions, they couldn't sit down or lie down, they were just crammed in there, and that was one of the parts out of Africa. It is a museum that really brings to life the work of Red Cross and the work of André Dunant. If you're ever in Geneva, it's well worth going to see. It's quite moving, actually, and perhaps to some people quite gruesome, but here.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Joan, it was an excellent synopsis of the Red Cross, especially from a Hastings perspective. And I guess the thing that strikes me about Red Cross is its credibility. It's really great to hear, you know, there's a lot of people in this age especially are very cynical about when they give money to organisations about how much actually goes to it and the real credibility that it has. So we thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.